Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the SOM TV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. I am incredibly honored and so relieved to tell you that Cup of Salvation is blowing up on SOM TV. It is the most watched thing we have ever released, and in record time. I want to thank all of you guys so much for coming in, supporting this film. And if you're not a SOM TV subscriber, you need to go to SOMTV.com, subscribe, and watch. We have over 3 hours of bonus features, new documentaries, extended scenes, all sorts of stuff. So it's not just the film, it's an entire ecosystem around it. So go to SOMTV and watch that. The next question I keep getting asked is, how do I get the wines in the film? And I think people were not expecting a movie like this, you know, something that was this emotional and this big and this dangerous. So the big question is, where do I get the wines? On today's podcast, we're going to talk about one of those wines, the most dangerous wine in the world, and how we pulled that off. But before we do, I want to tell everybody, you can get the wines, the Armenian wines from the film, at storicawines.com. When we first started filming the movie, these wines didn't have distribution. You couldn't get them in the United States. And so when Storica Wines came in kind of midway through while we were editing this, it was a huge relief because I knew this was going to be a very tough film to release if you could not get these wines. So storicawines.com, they have put together a 4-pack of all the wines in the movie, and they'll ship it right to your house. The only better way to watch this movie is to do it with the wines in the film. So go to storicawines.com to get the wines in Cup of Salvation. On today's podcast, I'm going to speak with Fahi Kushgarian, the main character of the fourth SOM film, Cup of Salvation. And we are going to go through how we pulled off that wine in the film. You know the one. And there's going to be some spoilers. So I would say if you have not seen the movie and you don't want it spoiled for you, this is a really crazy thing that happens in the movie. A lot of geopolitics involved, very dangerous. And there's been a lot of press about this particular wine. I would watch the film and then come back to this podcast. I recorded this with Fahi in New York City while we were filming the movie. We are drinking that bottle and at 1/5 restaurant where we filmed. It's a pretty open conversation about our fears. Are we in danger because of what we did and how it came about and how this wine exists, really. So if you're okay with spoilers or have already seen the film, here I am with Fahi Kushgarian talking about the most dangerous wine in the world. For the rest of you, go to SOMTV.com and watch the film first and come right back. I'm here with Fahi Kushgarian. Fahi and I, we started a film in 2019. Does that sound right? We started filming in Armenia?
Yes.
So this is a film that if I could have made this when I made SOM 1, I would have made this film. This is a film that's taken me nearly 12 years of a professional career to convince anybody to let me make a film about the history of wine, religion, you know. It's batshit crazy. I mean, the amount of stuff that's in this movie, we'll get to, but it all starts with you. It's a very strange thing. I never thought I would be sitting here speaking about, filming in Iran, you know, for a film that I directed. It's very, very strange. And I will just say, we're sitting here with a bottle of Molana, which is made from the Rasha grape in Iran. And while we were filming this movie, which is an incredible story of what I will call the awakening of Armenia, a country that goes back to Neolithic times, has very rarely been its own country. It's been occupied by many, many, many different countries, you know, from the Ottomans to the Russians to, I mean, it goes back and back. The Mongols at a point. As we were doing that, we ended up filming in the Vatican, and this Iranian thing popped up as a possibility for you to go and truck some grapes. Now, I would assume when this is released, the film is also available. So I think people listening and watching this will have seen the movie. Fahi, I just wanted to say before I let you talk that I think you are one of the craziest, most inspiring people I've ever met. And I just want to toast a glass of wine from Persia with you right now.
Thank you, Chase.
let me ask you really fast as we get going. What was it that made you want to become a winemaker? Why did you become a winemaker?
Because winemaking would have given me, I started as a wine importer in California. So it would have been, that career, first I knew wine and I loved wine because I was a restaurateur. And then I wanted to move on and do other things. And being involved in wine would open many opportunities to travel, to see, to work with winemakers, bring their wines to the U.S. at the time. That was my goal, bringing them to California and selling wine. So that was the reason. But once I started importing, that was not enough. Then I want to live in Tuscany. I went to Tuscany. Then that wasn't enough. I had to make wine there. So I leased vineyards. I made wine there. Then that was enough. Then I made Puglia. You know, so it's kind of a progression of what's the next thing I can do? What's the next exciting thing that I could do?
Yeah.
So that's how I got into the business of making wine, you know.
I wonder, you know, me being an American who grew up in the Midwest of the United States, I didn't know a lot of Armenians. Armenians are not, you know, they're not a huge amount of people. They're an ancient people. And when I started this project, Armenia was the focus. There's a discovery of a cave, I should say, that happened in Armenia called the Arni-1 Complex, and it's in the film, and it very well might be the oldest, quote-unquote, winery in the world, you know, a place where wine was systematically made. And so one thing I want to ask you is, does it feel incredibly frustrating that people don't know of Armenia as a winemaking region on a large scale when they were practically the inventors of it? I mean, does that piss you off a little bit?
Yes. At some point, at least the wine industry, wine professionals will know, and a lot of them do know, or wine lovers do know, that that's where it goes. But that's where it ends, because most people would be difficult to find Armenia on a map. Because it's a small nation. It was ex-Soviet Union, so it was one of the republics. So there are many reasons not to remember. So it's not like we can find fault. But the wine, that it was one of the birthplaces, if not the birthplace of the wine, having the oldest, technically most systematic winemaking winery in a cave in Armenia, dated 6,100 years ago, is the wine industry, and Armenia will find its place in the as a winemaking country within the next 10 few. It's already getting there, but it's going to take a little bit more, where, let's say, it took 25 years for New Zealand to get on the map. Not 25 years,
and
but
bunch
now...
And a bunch of very cheap Sauvignon Blanc.
Yes, exactly. And then all of a sudden it became, same with Argentina, with Malbec. Ours is a little bit different because we're even older than Western Europe. We're the historic world, you know. Some people use the ancient world, but I prefer historic because we're still alive. So it's historic in that context,
okay.
You know.
Right.
So that's why being a historic world, it will find its, let's say, its enological voice. People will, we will make wine worthy of the history of Vidya.
I think you already do. I mean, look, I will say this. The red and the sparkling wines you make out of the Arni grape, and there's other grapes. I think the pronunciation thing is a little tricky. You know, Voskehat and things are not, they're not grapes that people have heard of.
Sure.
Arni, A-R-E-N-I, that's real easy to say. That's easy. That's as easy to say as Malbec.
Yes.
Easier to say than Pinot Noir.
Or Cabernet Sauvignon.
I have members of my family that'll still say Pinot Noir. You know, I mean, it's not the easiest thing. Cabernet, you know, Arni is pretty easy to say.
Yeah, you can't mistake. You can't mispronounce it. Let's put it that way.
I just want everybody listening to understand how freaking good Arni is as a grape when it's in the hands of somebody. So, like the way you say we're gonna make wine, you are making wine at a level that, and it's criminally underpriced. I'm afraid about this movie making that a problem for me because I really like the wines that you make. And so I you know, just starting with the idea of Armenia. Now, I want to ask you a little weird controversy, because I know Georgia, the country of Georgia, you know, which is north of you guys, has this. Their entire identity is that they invented wine, right? Well, I mean, who really invented wine? Does this matter? There were no countries back then.
I don't think it does. Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
there were people there. You know, it was. They weren't Armenians. The, you know, Urartians were before us. So it's, but it was the people come and go, and the land and the terroir stays.
Uh-huh.
So, and that's what matters. It's not, I don't care who, what started. the fact is that we have the oldest winery. Okay, then what? But now it's also proven that it's 11,000 genetically, they've dated it. Now it's 11,000 years is who it got domesticated. But it's the Southern Caucasus. It's Georgia, Armenia, could be Iran, is where all the action happened of domesticating the vine. And with the birth of Vitis vinifera, that's where it happened. Does it matter? No. What matters is the terroir. Yes? So Georgia might, but Georgia is, we have completely different terroirs, so it's not comparable. Georgia is almost sea level, clay, soil. Ours is high elevation volcanic soil. So there are right grapes for this terroir, right grapes for those terroirs to make great wines or very good wines. So I don't think it's comparable. I think I've had good Georgian wines. You know, the difference being Georgia has been making wine continuously. Even during the Soviet Union, they were making wine.
So they haven't lost the culture.
You know.
Right.
I don't agree on some of the things they're doing now, sticking too much to the old narrative of amphora, usage of amphora and whatnot, but that's their choice. You know, some Armenian producers are doing it. So there are some similarities, but for the most part, our terroirs are very different.
I picture you getting like into a fight with a bunch of Georgian gangsters over the birthplace of wine in some bar in Moscow. That's like, yeah. You know. So when we set out to make this film, obviously religion and wine, it cannot be overstated how linked they are to each other. You know, I mean, it goes from the, you know, maybe people drank a bunch of wine, got drunk and found God, or maybe they found a way to get closer to religion when they made wine. There's and there is a strong argument made by smarter people than me that the Garden of Eden in the Bible could be located in the region, you know, right by where you guys are. And it'd come to make some sense. I mean, in the Bible, you have Mount Ararat where Noah's Ark landed. And of course, he made wine when he landed on that.
He planted the first vines, let's say.
Got himself nice and drunk, and that was that.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a fascinating concept to think of all the religions, Judaism, Zoroastrianism, which was it's the traditional old Persian religion that goes back thousands of years. Christianity, of course, where wine represents something, whether it is part of a celebration or it is the literal representation of the blood of the Son of God, things like that. But when you think of Islam, it's over. Part of the tenet of Islam is that alcohol is a poison to you. You're not allowed to consume it. And so when we were making a film about the origin of wine and religion, I never expected Islam to be a part of that story, considering it was kind of over. Now, I want to talk about the frankly batshit experience of making wine in a country like Iran. Now, for you, I think you would have a very different worldview on what Iran represents. For me, I was born in 1980, and a year prior, they had an Islamic revolution that the Americans were very involved in. We had hostages. It was a very, very Carter administration. It was a mess. So I grew up with Iran. I didn't know what to think. I didn't know what this country would be like. Now I realize it's pretty much a first world country. They have a very different regime than we are used to here in the United States. But I guess I'll flat out ask you, why were you willing to go into Iran and try to take these grapes into Armenia?
It's very clear. I'll give you a very clear answer.
Sure.
The reason I did it is once I discovered that Iran is part of this exclusive club of countries that are part of the historic world. The reason that it was prohibited made it even more attractive because no one else would do it. And I knew I would do it. It wasn't for the glory. It was for the gutsy thing to do. You know, it's like, oh, okay, I'm going to make one from Iran because you can't make wine there. And why shouldn't we make wine from Iran? I did in Armenia. I saw 10 years of growth. It was beautiful. The whole industry changed. The culture of winemaking changed. Dining changed. You know, now people do wine. So I wanted to see what we could do with Iran. And it was a curiosity as a winemaker. It's the excitement of making wine. in... I can't get excited making wine in Argentina, let's say. A lot of people have gone ahead of me. You know, Michel Roland, Paul Hobbs, Antonini, you know, potatoes. Roberto Cipresso. All of them, they went there early and they discovered, you know. And I'm looking around and, you know, what's left to discover? Iran is like the prize, you know, the impossible one. And I wanted to do it. Just because it was exciting, but I knew there were great grapes.
Right.
So that's what motivated me to go.
But how did you know? How did you know? So we should say that grapes, as you mentioned, they thousands of years have been grown in Iran.
Yes.
And they go back to Cyrus the Great. They go back Alexander the Great, you know, all this stuff. So the question is, how did you actually know that there was going to be anything to find when you got there?
These are all raisins
and food now. They don't...
Statistically, I mean, now there are numbers that there are this many vineyards out there.
Okay.
What I didn't know was that there were a lot of... I went once to Tabriz in Iran, in the northern part near Lake Urmia, where also there's an Armenian community. That was my first trip to go and check it out, to sniff around. And I found a professor who wasn't particularly willing to talk unless, and then we got to know each other. He took me to vineyards. There was an Armenian guy who had a nursery growing plants. And I figured out that a few of the varieties were not table varieties. They were wine varieties. And if there were wine, they all were looking at me like, okay, you don't know. But there was a lot of bad wine being made because they don't have any technology.
Well, they make it in their basement.
Okay. But the culture is there. And if it has lasted that long, if they have Hagi Firuz Tepe, which is they find artifacts of winemaking that went thousands of years, you can conclude that the grapes had to be good.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, no culture would advance this much, the wine culture. So I gambled that there are good grapes to be had. I didn't know that not only table grapes, but there would be wine grapes. And I was right, and there are lots of wine grapes there that are not useful for eating because they're seeded, small berries, lots of skin. So, you know, they're not that juicy table grapes that people would do. So it wasn't a very shot in the dark, but it was an educated guess that there is something there that needs to be discovered.
We should talk about the wine for a sec because we're drinking it. Now, I'm among the very, if not the first person in the United States to taste this wine. So when I guess I owe an explanation. I didn't know what to expect from this wine because, I mean, obviously I've been filming this, but now it's finally here. And when I held this bottle the other day, and honestly, I almost burst into tears in the weirdest way. And it's a culmination of how hard this film has been to make and how much I love it and I'm excited. But also the fact that you saw this all the way to the end and it's coming. We are going to have an Iranian Persian wine in the United States, which I don't know that you're allowed to call it that, but we'll, you know, but that's okay. This is going to happen. Now, here's the good news. The wine's freaking great. I mean, it's one of these things where that story is enough to sell a wine, but it might not be enough to sell two bottles. Maybe not enough to sell two cases. This wine, we spent a little time off mic trying to describe what is it like. And I think I settled on something that reminds me a lot of Grenache, Garnacha. It's a lot lighter than I expected. It's got a tannin structure that is... makes it feel full, but it's not overwhelming at all. It's very soft and integrated. This does not taste like a wine that you just bottled and flew from halfway across, all the way across the globe and put in my glass right here. You know, it's just, I don't really understand how this is as good as it is because you had no ability to monitor how these grapes were grown. You found them and you picked them and you got the hell out of the country. So did you get lucky?
Yes, in some ways. But it was luck in the making, you know, through contacts, people knew in the industry. I knew how to do it, how to get it, and how not to damage the quality of the grapes until they made it to Armenia. So that's one part. But I don't look at this. I mean, yes, it's wonderful, great fruit. This, your descriptions of integrated tannins is right on the money. But I am seeing, even greater things. Because now, with this result, we can focus zero on farming if we can. More selection.
Do you think they're going to let you back in, though?
I don't know. I mean, no one has put on a fatwa.
While we record this, the movie has not come out.
Look, but. I mean, I'll send someone else. It's not like they're going to block everybody. But I'll find someone who can go and do it. But we have the channels and we're going to do, unless they block the exit of all grapes.
No, because they export good fruit. It's
exactly,
fruit. I mean,
exactly.
So this is something I wanted to bring up. Neither of us are Muslim, of course, but we didn't break any Islamic laws. It's not like it's
not in the country we did.
In the country
we did. Yes.
I mean, well, making wine, fermenting grapes. I don't know if that's
Yes.
Okay, fine. But we didn't do it in the state. It didn't happen in Iran.
It happened outside.
On a technical level. You didn't really do anything wrong. You just brought some fruit. You could have brought melons or berries or anything, right? And you could ferment melon if you wanted
to. Actually, you can look at it that I did a favor to the farmers and I am helping the currency get into the country by taking wine out.
I just want for the record, I had nothing to do with this. I had no currency exchange as an American. I had nothing to do with any money exchanging in Iran. I just want everyone to know. I want my mother to know who's listening. I did not break any international laws.
Yeah, no. No, it's really...
Not this time, at least.
There is none, honestly. Yeah. So it could be a wonderful curiosity, or it could be something that they would try to avoid in the future. Mm-hmm. Yeah, who knows? I have no idea. But I'm kind of, I'm willing. I'm ready. I've taken the risk already. There's no going back. I can't unscramble eggs. So I'm hoping, that at least it serves a purpose,
Right. So
people drinking Iranian wine and getting, for Iranians, it would be an emotional moment. If it's emotional for you, it's emotional for me. And for an Iranian who has been living in exile, and seeing a bottle of Iranian winemaking in exile written on it, it's an emotional moment for them. And because there's nothing more than wine and grapes to represent soil, land, and provenance. Mm-hmm. So if they're from that land, wine is the only thing that can't be replicated. You can do tomatoes everywhere, strawberries everywhere. You can't make wine everywhere. You can't make Iranian wine anywhere except in Iran. And that's the beauty of winemaking. And so that we can do Hermitage in France, we can do Champagne in Champagne. That's because the soil is chalky or it's clay or the mountains, the slopes are sudden exposure and so on and so forth. And that we were able to grasp that, go find godforsaken vineyards in Iran, harvest them, put them in a truck, bring them to Armenia, and sharing it with the world and, let's say, passionate Iranians who haven't had a chance to taste anything from their country of wine on this level, is wonderful, is the right word. It's beautiful. It's a gift. If I was an Iranian having a bottle of wine, I would tear up. But even one bottle with family members, because you don't know what exile means. We don't know what not having your homeland means because you're from here.
That's right.
I know because I went from my father from southern regions of the Ottoman Empire to Syria, to Lebanon. I went from Syria to Lebanon to Italy to the U.S. back to Italy, Armenia.
There was no Armenia at that point.
No, and now this Armenia is an adopted Armenia because I'm not from there. I'm from Western Armenia, but now, for all intents and purposes, it's my homeland. So now I can make wine there and plant vineyards there and not worry what's going to happen, because my kids or grandkids are going to take care of it. But when I was in Italy, I didn't want to plant vineyards. Who's going to take care of them? It means my kids are going to... And I didn't have an emotional attachment. So for Iranians, it would be... And I am hoping one day, when it opens up, some of them go back and in their old villages and get some vineyards or plant vineyards and make wine. There's nothing more beautiful than that. Almost poetic.
I think where I sit, and I have made projects about the Judgment of Paris, I have talked endlessly about Robert Parker and all the things in wine that have changed things. Without any hyperbole, I think this is the most important thing that has happened to wine in at least the last 250 years, if not more. I mean, maybe when Dom Perignon, you know, did what he did and figured out how to make a white wine from a red grape. I think that the fact that he carbonated stuff is bullshit. That's not true. But he did make a white wine from a red grape. And that might be, after that, going into Iran, at least from an American point of view, I think this is one of the most significant things that I have seen, because I have been of the belief that wine and food, but especially wine, is never really about wine. It's about everything else, history and love and geopolitics and war and religion. And I think you've managed in this bottle and your Kush sparkling wine and all these to put all of those things into one bottle. And I don't know if you'll ever get to go back to Iran and make more wine. I know that you are the eternal optimist and somehow you'll find a way. Even if you don't, there's 10 or 12,000 bottles of this wine out there in the world soon, and if not now. And man, I am just floored by you pulling this off.
Thank you.
I'll just ask one more question. Are you nervous about anything happening because of this?
No. I am pretty calm. I don't know what will happen. It might happen, but I'm not losing sleep.
I mean, no one's going to kill you for this.
No. That would be way too much. It's overkill, as they say.
Yes, right,
that would be like, okay. You know, they could kill me for other things, but not this one. and I wouldn't go as much as saying it would be worth it. No, nothing is worth dying.
Yeah.
You know, we still have a lot to do in life. We have...
You got to make wine in
Many
you
got to
make
projects.
Wine in North Korea,
yeah,
right?
Now with the global warming, you know, Holland,
North Korean wine.
Sweden is looking pretty good right now.
Sweden,
yeah, at least we can do bubbles and stuff like that. But thank you for I wouldn't say the compliment that you gave me or the how you are perceiving it to be. And if it's anywhere close, then I'm happy that I was part of the narrative of getting stuff done out of Iran with Iranian grapes in Iran terroir. Time will tell how it will evolve. Yeah, but I know the reality, the impact that it will have or has in the wine world. Let's put it that way. Yeah. So
fair.
I look forward to making greater things. So time will tell.
Well. Everybody needs to watch the film because the whole story is in there. So, bye. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jason. It's wonderful. It's great. Absolutely wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Let's not do this again.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, my friend. Cheers.
Good. Cheers. I want to thank everybody for listening. I want to thank Vahe for putting his life at risk to be in this film and to make such a passionate product. I mean, his wines are incredible. And again, if you want to get the wines from the film, the one we talked about or the Armenian wines, go to storicawines.com. They've assembled a 4-pack for all of you to order and then rewatch the film and watch all the bonus features and watch all of this stuff. And if you have SOM TV, you can watch this conversation I just had on SOM TV. So that is streaming there. I want to thank John Adams, who produced this podcast and also did all of the sound for Cup of Salvation. He's a wonderful audio engineer for SOM TV. And all the rest of you, have a great, safe time, and do not go messing around in countries that do not allow alcohol. All right, behave yourselves.